Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last Thursday, a shooting at the nation's largest military base left 13 dead and many more wounded. The alleged gunman is one of the Army's own, Major Nidal Malik Hassan, a military psychiatrist facing deployment in a war he opposed. As details emerge about the shootings at Fort Hood, so do questions about warning signs and an entire military under stress. This hour On Point, the Fort Hood tragedy. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the horrible events at Fort Hood? What should the Army and the country, how should they respond? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In this hour, we'll put the Fort Hood shooting in context. Joining me first from Austin, Texas, is Peter Sanders, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's been reporting from Fort Hood. Peter, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks, Jane. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Can you give us the headline today, Peter? What's the latest on the investigation?
Well, the latest on the investigation, the big headline appears to be Major Hassan's condition. He has been in a military hospital in San Antonio since Saturday, or maybe late Friday night. He was transferred down there and taken off the ventilator and the respirator Saturday. And as of this morning, it's being reported that he's actually awake and talking to investigators, although the military, through last night, had sort of refused to comment on his condition other than he was in critical but stable condition. So obviously all signs right now are pointing towards Major Hassan as people are looking for motive and have a lot of questions that need to be answered.
Exactly. So does it appear, based on what you know you're reporting, that the gunman, that he acted alone, or was he part of a larger plot?
Well, that's sort of the big question and the big sticking point right now. The military has been very careful in how they word their statements. The Army is still leading the investigation here. The Army is very careful to say that this time they believe he was the only shooter on Thursday and the only gunman. At this time, they also say they believe he acted alone, but they're being very careful to keep it sort of vague whether or not he had help before the shooting or he was in contact with other people. They're definitely not commenting on that.
Were there signs of premeditation?
Well, you know, I've been at Fort Hood since early Friday morning, and so I'm just sort of had been reporting from that angle in sort of on the ground there. You know, there have been reports that I've seen elsewhere that he, you know, had made comments or was posting on websites in regards to some of his beliefs. But of that, I'm not exactly sure, and I'm sure that is one question that everyone's looking at.
The day of the shooting, Peter, there were reports that Major Nidal Hassan methodically moved around the room, sparing some people while firing on others. Does it appear he discriminated among his targets?
Well, again, that's, you know, that is something that's out there. It's still has not been commented on directly by investigators. However, of the victims, of the 13 that were killed, a number of whom were mental health professionals or medical professionals who worked in the psychiatric care field. So, you know, Major Hassan was not supposed to be in that building that day. The Army had said that yesterday, that he had no business being at the Readiness Center on Thursday. So it does appear that there were some victims that were shot that were sort of associated with his field of medicine.
How are the victims, Peter?
Well, you know, there are 30 that were shot, 30 wounded in addition to the 13 killed. Of those, 16 are still in the hospital, or as of last night were still in the hospital, 9 of whom are in a normal inpatient care, and 7 of whom still are in the intensive care units. Some still face additional surgeries for gunshot wounds. And obviously there are a lot of folks that are already have been released from the hospital and are just starting to heal.
Obviously, this is a very emotional time in many places, but especially at Fort Hood. Here's a little bit of sound from a church service yesterday at Fort Hood. Army Chaplain Colonel Frank Jackson told the congregation to look for the good.
So, Lord, as we pray together, we focus on things we know. We are humbled and grateful for the outpouring of love and the support of this community and our nation.
Peter Sanders, can you describe the impact on Fort Hood, how the soldiers, the civilians are coping?
Well, you know, obviously Fort Hood is the largest U.S. military base in the states, and it's a huge facility and surrounded by Killeen, Texas, which has, you know, primarily military folks. And the truth is, at churches yesterday, I visited 3 Baptist churches yesterday. They were full of people grieving. But at the end of the day, you know, at the end of the day, it is still an Army facility. The Army folks have been, most of them, but putting on a pretty good face, and the Army is quick to obviously point out that these are soldiers, and many of them have already been to Iraq and Afghanistan multiple times. So, you know, things are sort of, on one hand, it's obviously extremely sad, and everyone has heavy hearts. On the other hand, things are sort of operating as usual in terms of it being an Army base and an Army town.
So the personnel, military personnel, still being deployed then as planned?
Absolutely. The readiness center where the shootings occurred is still a crime scene. As of last night, it was still locked down. The FBI and Army investigators were there. But they've actually moved the readiness center to another part of the base and are still processing soldiers for deployment as scheduled. And according to the Army, over the weekend, none of the units that were at the readiness center and involved in the shooting, apparently none of their deployment schedules have been affected. So things are moving along.
How is the Army generally dealing with this incident? What are they pursuing in specific with their investigation?
That's a very good question. I mean, it seems relatively still unclear exactly what they're pursuing. They have searched and seized items from Major Hassan's apartment. They are interviewing witnesses. They've interviewed over 170 people involved at the victims of the crime. They are looking for additional people who may have been there and left the scene before the investigators got to them. So they are sort of canvassing the base. They are looking deeply into Major Hassan's history, and just at the same time releasing very little information, I think partly because, you know, this is one of their own, and this is a very sensitive issue.
Peter Sanders, thank you very much for your time and information.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Peter Sanders is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He joined me from Austin, Texas. Joining me now from Washington is Ann Scott Tyson, military and Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. Ann, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Also from Washington, we're joined by Daniel Zwerdling, national correspondent for National Public Radio. He's looked closely at mental health and the military and has spent a lot of time at Walter Reed Hospital with veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Daniel, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Ann.
Daniel, I'll begin with you. If Major Hassan was acting alone, as has been reported, as far as we know he was, based on your reporting, can you help us understand the context in which he carried out this act?
I've talked to a number of psychiatrists who worked closely with him at Walter Reed, and they paint the picture of a very troubled guy. And one thing several have said is if this is not exactly the sort of behavior you would expect of a terrorist, somebody to broadcast his odd behavior. First of all, from the time he came to Walter Reed about 6 years ago, for most of that time, his colleagues and supervisors thought that he was a really substandard student and psychiatrist in training. I mean, he just did not do the work of being a psychiatrist the way they want to see it done. They say he seemed uninterested in his patients often. He didn't show up on time. His patient notes, where you're supposed to catalog, you know, here's how Jane's symptoms have progressed over the last few weeks. Here's the medications we've changed. He wouldn't even fill in a lot of those notes. So when another psychiatrist would take over the case of you, Jane, they wouldn't even know all the big changes you had been through. So in all kinds of ways, just as a doctor, they thought that he was doing a pretty bad job. Now, in addition to that, they say he had very odd behaviors. He was very proud of being a Muslim, and that didn't bother anybody. But psychiatrists say he would suddenly sort of fly off the handle, and out of the blue, he would start assaulting people. That's how they interpreted it. He would start assaulting his colleagues for their Christian beliefs. One psychiatrist said it got to the point where it was impossible to work with him sometimes, and the psychiatrist would leave the room. And one person said, you know, it's not like a bunch of people are sitting around NPR or WBUR or whatever, you know, talking about religion. And then a slightly belligerent colleague says, now, let me tell you what I think about religion. They say, this is not what they're talking about. They wouldn't be talking about religion at all. They would be silent. They'd be walking through the hallway. They'd be sitting doing their work in a room. And suddenly, out of nowhere, he would start belligerently talking about Christianity. And in their view, trying to make them feel like hypocrites for what they believed or didn't believe about Christianity. Mm. And the thing that really set off a lot of alarm bells for people was a grand rounds presentation that Nidal Hassan gave around June of 2007. And by the way, one of the mysteries about him is, how do we pronounce his name? Some of his family say Oweep, say Hassan. Some people at Walter Reed said we always called him Dr. Hassan, and he never corrected us, but, you know, a lot of people mispronounced my name, and they call me Zwerdlinger, you know, and I don't correct him because I don't want him to feel bad. So I don't even know exactly how he pronounces his name. But anyway, he gave this grand rounds presentation, and picture this, it's an auditorium, And doctors take turns going to the podium, and they give a PowerPoint presentation, such as, you know, what are new modalities for treatment of schizophrenia? You know, what are drug interactions for, you know, personality disorder medication, that sort of thing. But instead of giving an academic presentation, he proceeded to give what they say was an hour lecture on the Quran. And I said to them, well, that, you know, maybe that's unusual, but that maybe he's just trying to give good information, because most of us who aren't Muslim don't really know much about the Quran. And they say, no. The tone of it was very, very weird. He was saying, you know, infidels who do not believe in Islam, you know, they live hell on earth. Their heads must be cut off, hot oil poured down their throats. They should be, you know, consumed live by fire. And he talked about how Muslims are oppressed and will rise up. And they, again, they say it was the tone of this Grand Rounds presentation that bothered everybody, because it seemed very much like he believed it. And in fact, at one point, a psychiatrist who's another psychiatrist who's also a Muslim and is very popular, this other fellow was elected chief resident by his peers. They respect him and like him so much. He raised his hand, according to the reports I've received, and said, excuse me, but a lot of Muslims, and I'm a Muslim, a lot of Muslims do not interpret the Quran in this violent way that you are interpreting it. We interpret the Quran as spreading a message of peace. Hassan looked at him and said, next, and clicked the PowerPoint to go on to the next slide, and I wouldn't even address that. So they say they were troubled by this guy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the tragedy at Fort Hood. Anne Scott Tyson is with us. She's military and Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. And Daniel Zwerdling is with us. He's national correspondent for NPR. On Fox News yesterday, Senator Joe Lieberman said the Fort Hood shooting could be a politically and religiously motivated crime. Senator Lieberman said he may want to open hearings to investigate the incident.
We don't know enough to say now, but there are very, very strong warning signs here that Dr. Hassan had become an Islamist extremist and therefore that this was a terrorist act.
And Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, said yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation that it's difficult to know what kinds of warning signs from Major Hassan should have raised red flags.
You can be in the military and disagree with policy. What did his coworkers say about his behavior? How strong were the warning signals? At the end of the day, maybe this is just about him. It's certainly not about his religion, Islam. It's not about the army. It's not about the war. At the end of the day, I think it's going to be about him. And if we miss some signals, some clear signals, we got to fix that. And I trust the army to want to fix it.
Anne Scott Tyson, did the army miss important warning signs here?
Well, the Army has not yet stated whether he actually tried to leave or what efforts he made to express dissatisfaction with his service, a concern about deploying to Afghanistan. They have not confirmed what his family has stated, which was that he did want to, in fact, leave the military. So what is not known is what were his interactions with people at different levels. In other words, did he express these concerns? Did he ever go to try either to be discharged or say that he didn't want to do a certain assignment? What were his interactions with his superiors, and what did they do based on those? I mean, just from the earlier comments about the poor performance and his unusual, somewhat strident behavior at Walter Reed, I would think that that certainly would have been recorded in some kind of performance review. Another key factor, however, to put this in context, on one hand, you would have these possible warning signs, and it does sound as though certainly some things were overlooked. But on one hand, he hadn't deployed, so he didn't have to go through the routine pre- and post-deployment mental health screening that goes on that might have made these things more prominent. So it's uncertain what sort of routine evaluations, you know, a person who isn't deploying might have gone through. Another side of this whole thing is that because there is tremendous need for officers in his field,
right,
that he would, it's very possible that some of these things could have been overlooked because there was simply no one else to fill his slot, no one else to do his job.
Let me bring in some of our listeners into the conversation at this point. Krista is first up. She's calling from Howell, Michigan. Krista, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My sister is just returned from deployment the day before the shootings to Fort Hood. And prior to her return, she received both formal and informal counseling about post-deployment stress. I'm wondering if the series of redeployments for soldiers and officers would change the pre-deployment counseling for people that maybe haven't fully recovered from the stress of their last deployment or are facing additional stresses of an unknown deployment.
Mm. Krista, thank you. Daniel Zwerdling, what do you know about that?
I don't know the answer to that. Anne?
Might you, Anne?
Well, I think that the question was, would the shootings impact the screenings?
Pre-deployment soldiers going out.
Well, I mean, I think certainly they have a standard set of questions that they ask that is fairly consistent because they do want to have some sort of baseline gauge of these of mental health symptoms over time. I think that what is very likely, I mean, again, having heard some of these statements, some of these concerns, that if he was going through a screening and had made some of these statements, I think people would have picked up on it based on what I hear from soldiers who have other types of problems, serious depression, perhaps suicidal tendencies. A good screener will pick up on that and will act on it. Obviously, people, if they want to, can simply lie, not report how they're truly feeling, and people do slip through the cracks. But, you know, in this case, as of cases of, of soldiers who are mentally troubled, for example, when they're reviewing the suicides in great detail, they always find in most cases, they find things that could have been done or things that were often missed.
May I add something?
Yes, please, Daniel.
One of the issues I've been reporting on for the last couple of days is, why weren't more things done to intervene with him when people over the last 6 years were concerned about his behavior as a doctor? I mean, put aside any odd behaviors or behaviors they thought were odd that had to do with his religion. Just as a doctor, a lot of people were concerned. And I think I can't go into detail about what I've been finding out, except to say that the military and the government, and by the government, I mean the military and the medical professions, have a long tradition in which it is very, very difficult to get rid of people even when you are deeply concerned about their job performance. Mm-hmm. We've all heard stories about doctors at, the Acme Hospital in, something, Missouri. I'm making this up, the name of the hospital. We've all heard stories about doctors who have been sued for horrendous malpractice, investigated, found to have committed malpractice, who continue to practice medicine, right? They sometimes at the same hospitals, but often they just move on to a different hospital. In the government, it is sort of, it's become almost legion that it is very hard to get rid of people unless they've done something egregious. And the military is part of the government. And it's one thing to say, look at that private over there. He's come back. He's messed up. He's psychologically unfit. It's one thing to get rid of that guy or young woman, and it's pretty easy. But it is very difficult to get rid of an officer. Once you've gone beyond a certain level, a certain number of years, it is almost automatic that you will keep being promoted. So people have said, how could he be major if there were these concerns? Well, it's almost like, the calendar says it's January 1st, you're major now. So I think a part of the issue just has to do with how these structures are put in place over the years to make it difficult to get rid of people. But there's a good reason for that. In the old days, before all these safeguards were put in place, people could be fired left and right. And so these safeguards were put in so that you can't just get rid of people who you think are odd. You have to, document it over a long period of time and bring a case against them. And it's hard to do in the military and in medicine.
Speaking yesterday on ABC's This Week, Army Chief of Staff General George Casey was asked about how the Fort Hood shooting might impact Muslims now going forward in the military.
And I think the speculation could potentially heighten backlash against some of our Muslim soldiers. And what happened at Fort Hood was a tragedy. But I believe it would be an even greater tragedy if our diversity becomes a casualty here. And it's not just about Muslims. We have a very diverse army. We have a very diverse society. And that gives us all strength. So again, we need to be very careful with that.
Diversity becoming a casualty here. Daniel Zwerdling, after a terrible incident like this, is that a real possibility?
Well, I think it was good that General Casey mentioned that. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the colleagues of another Muslim psychiatrist at Walter Reed thought so highly of him that they voted to make him chief resident. So at least at Walter Reed, where I'm talking with medical people, there's no backlash against anybody being Muslim. And in fact, some psychiatrists I've talked with have speculated, and I want to stress this is, well, actually it's speculation, so I'm not even going to, I'm going to be responsible and not go there.
Tyson, Ann Scott Tyson, do you believe that that's a real possibility, this sort of backlash against Muslims in the military?
Well, I think putting this in context of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, with all the deployments over there, the military generally, I would say, has become very sensitized to Muslim, the religion, to culture and cultural sensitivities and so forth. So if anything, I would say the population of the military now might be less likely to backlash than maybe the broader American public. The military, interestingly, has actually, although clearly there have been discrimination problems as in the rest of society, but in many ways it has integrated more quickly and more readily than other parts of the country. And I think that, therefore, I would hope that there would not be a significant backlash, but there certainly could be more scrutiny because of this incident.
Here's a call from...
Can I just mention quickly, Daniel, go ahead, please. If you look at what's happened at Fort Hood, in line with what Anne's saying, there has been no, you know, that we anybody we know has reported on, no hate signs, no, you know, ugly mail sent to Muslims. I mean, you know, there are, people are going on with their lives. So far, there doesn't seem to be a backlash, thank goodness.
Let's hear from Omaha, Nebraska. Dennis is on the line. Thanks for waiting, Dennis. Welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello, my name is Dennis Kerr. I am a PFC chaplain assistant in the Army National Guard, and I want to say right off, I don't speak for the Army or for the chaplain corps, and I'm a chaplain assistant. I'm an enlisted assistant to chaplains, and my roommate in the barracks was Muslim, and his religion was not a problem with us. But I think this situation underscores the need for more chaplains, and in particular more Muslim chaplains. I've seen firsthand how chaplains have diffused situations many times, and people who just like the people you go to church with or go to synagogue with, they were diffused before they killed themselves or did something to someone else. And so it would be good if we had more chaplains in general, and in particular had Muslim chaplains so that Muslim folks can have a chaplain too.
Dennis, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. I hear Dennis saying he didn't have a problem in the military, but I'm reading on the front page of the New York Times today, Ann Scott Tyson, the suspect, Major Hassan, once describing how he received great harassment in the military through family members who described that someone once put a diaper in his car saying, "That's your headdress." Another case cited by relatives, someone had drawn a camel on his car, written under it, "Camel jockey, get out." So at least from these reports, there were some problems, no?
Yeah, no, I agree. And we've reported on other things that happened, such as somebody, I don't know, scraping a key along his car. It's unclear whether that was sort of, I think it was, you know, maybe targeting him by someone who had, a soldier who had come back from Iraq. So, I mean, clearly, I'm not trying to say that this doesn't exist, just that there is a broader sensitizing, I think, of the military population. And his family has reported that he felt some harassment, and that probably added to his, you know, his frustration with life in the military overall.
But may I add something to that?
Okay, please.
There have, you know, in the military, it's not unusual. I'm not saying this is good at all, but it's not unusual for especially lower level troops to make fun of people of different ethnic persuasions. Sometimes they think it's funny, you know, and it's not. But I did a story about a young man who's Native American who got serious PTSD and was badly treated by the command structure at Fort Carson in Colorado. And he had documented over the years, you know, people calling him all kinds of hateful names because he was an Indian, you know, and whooping and, you know, where's your headdress and, you know, stupid stuff like that. So it's not just Muslims who get it. It's all kinds of people, Jews, Native Americans, people of every persuasion. One thing the doctors at Walter Reed say, and again, these are medical colleagues of Hassan's, they say that to the extent if he told anybody that he was not liked because he's Muslim at Walter Reed, that makes them really angry because they say the only reason people didn't like him at Walter Reed and he was widely not liked is that he had weird, you know, he treated some people pretty badly, they thought. And that was the only thing that had to do with why, you know, but and several have speculated that maybe in his mind, as people do who are very defensive and who you know, think the world is against him, as they felt he did, that you blame it on something like, oh, it's my ethnicity, and that's why people are treating me this way.
Let's go to Grafton, Massachusetts. Scott is on the line. Scott, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Yes, hello, Ms. Clayson. I'd like to say that we all know that Major Hassan is a Muslim, but I'd like to say they keep harping on the media that I've heard on the radio, Islamo-fascist, terrorist. But let's be honest, when Timothy McVeigh bombed the Murrah building in Oklahoma City, you never heard on the media he was an Irish Catholic murderer, a terrorist. In Columbine, when Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris went on their killing spree, you never heard them referred to as Christian murderers. If this had been a Jew who had shot these people on the military base, they would never say he was of a Jewish race because they would be fearful of anti-Semitism. So the point I'm trying to make is, there is definitely a virulent anti-Muslim bigotry that is perpetuating around Major Hassan. And also, let's look at American in the workplace, like the post office factories. There is bullying. There is harassment on the job. This is why there have been a number of shootings in postal facilities. It's not just the military. It's civilian in schools. We have an epidemic of bullying. And torturing. I think Major Hassan was tortured physically, mentally. I think he snapped. And I'd like to also say that Islamofascism has been portrayed, that's the new term, the coin, it's been coined the term Islamofascism. But also, you never hear about racist Jewish Zionism. Which is
Scott, I hear your point. We're coming up against a break here. I'm going to have to jump in. Daniel, Ann, would you like to respond to the caller, Scott? Ann?
Well, I would simply say that, I mean, I understand one certainly doesn't want to leap to conclusions, but the investigation itself is looking into possible associations or ties with various Islamist extremist groups that have been, you know, supportive of Al-Qaeda and so forth. Most recently, front page of the Washington Post today has a story on investigators probing the background of Hassan's attending a mosque where led by a very radical imam. Now, that absolutely does not, many people have attended such mosques and not, you know, become radicalized or share those views, but it's not mere speculation.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the tragic shooting at Fort Hood and what it could mean for the military and the country. We're joined today by two top journalists, Ann Scott Tyson, military and Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, and Daniel Zwerdling, national correspondent for NPR. And with me now is Rayhan Salam. He's a fellow at the New American Foundation and a keen observer of American politics and culture. He wrote about the Fort Hood shootings last week in a piece titled "The Collateral Damage to Muslims." Rayhan, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Major Nidal Hassan's Muslim background has been a touchy subject through this. It's still unclear what his motivations were, but you worry that he's already caused significant collateral damage to the Muslim community. Would you explain that?
Well, basically, a lot of folks have pointed out, including one of your earlier callers, that there is something a little unfair about the idea that all Muslims should be placed under a pall of suspicion because of the actions of one man. Yet that's, you know, the fact, that's a fact of life, given that Muslims are still a fairly unfamiliar community in America. It's a fairly recent religious community. And as a result, it's just doesn't have the same presence in American cultural life, and so it's natural that there would be more suspicion, particularly since, you know, for many Americans, their biggest and most potent encounter with Islam is in the form of radical Islamic ideology. So I think that that is something that you have to deal with as a simple reality, that, you know, this kind of violent act is going to shape perceptions of Muslims.
Mm. Senator Joe Lieberman yesterday raised the possibility that the shootings at Fort Hood could have been a terrorist attack, his words. AP yesterday reported that Major Hassan was, quote, tied to the mosque of the 9/11 hijackers. Do you see these as honest statements or irresponsible statements?
I think that it's people trying to honestly grapple with, you know, a situation that we don't fully understand. But I think that there's another way of looking at this. You know, in many respects, people say that bin Laden and al-Qaeda intended to draw the United States into a conflict to create a kind of clash of civilizations. And the irony of Major Hassan's horrible crime could be that, you know, Muslims who could serve in the American military and contribute a great deal might be discouraged from doing so because of this pall of suspicion. General Casey noted that there are 30,000 Muslims, approximately 30,000, who are serving in the U.S. military right now. And, you know, considering that there are very few you know, folks in our military who have the linguistic skills they need in Arabic, Pashto, Dari, Urdu, and a lot of other languages that are strategically important, you can see how this is actually having a pretty serious impact on our ability to do our job well.
So you see from a recruiting standpoint that Muslims or those who are culturally diverse might shy away from joining the military.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the sad ironies of the situation because, again, a lot of folks are understandably saying, hey, wait a second, we have to subject Muslims to greater scrutiny. And I think that, you know, given what's happened here, subjecting people like Major Hassan who express, you know, really radical political views to greater scrutiny makes a lot of sense. But, you know, there is a concern about that. I mean, you know, if you, in this blanket way, subject people to more scrutiny, that's, of course, going to lead some people to decide, you know what, maybe a career in the military isn't right for me. Again, this is all very subtle stuff, but I think that it does have an effect.
The initial reaction, Ryan, from Muslim groups was to distance themselves from this man, from the gunman. But does it gloss over a certain reality related to conflicts of faith and service in the U.S. military?
Well, I think that in the earlier segment, my you know, fellow panelists were noting that Major Hassan was a very idiosyncratic guy, and he reacted to, you know, if someone keys your car, the logical response isn't to start killing people. You know, so it seems that he was a very fragile person, and, you know, while it could be true that he interpreted this as a conflict between his duty and his faith, that speaks more to his mental illness than any real conflict, I'd suggest.
What do you
think? In fact, could I?
Yes, Daniel Zwerdling.
The former colleagues of Hassan's at Walter Reed stressed this point very firmly. They said, in their view, this is not a guy who was shaped by, mainly shaped by and driven by being Muslim. This is a guy who had deep-rooted personality troubles. And he could have, a person like that could find, you know, any excuse to vent their psychological troubles. And in his case, it seemed to be, you know, he found a way through Islam. But that wasn't what was driving him. Do you understand the difference? They say basically this is a guy who was deeply troubled, and Rayon was, I think, just basically saying this. This was a guy who had really severe personality problems, in their view, and would have become unhinged no matter what. He just needed the excuse, and maybe this was the excuse.
Rayon, long-term impact here of this terrible tragedy at Fort Hood.
That's hard to say. I think that the long-term impact is not going to be as grave as a lot of us are fearing, because I think that, you know, when you're looking at the American Muslim community, it has integrated pretty successfully. It's a pretty affluent community. And so I see this as a serious tragedy that's not going to really stop that process of assimilation and integration. But I also think that when you look at the European case, you could imagine a world in which Muslims do become very alienated and very culturally isolated, particularly religiously observant Muslims. And I think that's a danger. I don't think that's going to come to pass, but you know, it's certainly something that we ought to be mindful of.
Rayhan Salam, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Rayhan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation. His article on Fort Hood shooting is titled "The Collateral Damage to Muslims." Let's go back to the phones now. Shireen is on the line waiting in Omaha, Nebraska. Shireen, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I would like to speak as an atheist in looking at the outside of these issues. Rayhan made a very good point about there being a pall of suspicion cast over Muslims because of this. However, my concern is, and perhaps Daniel could speak to this better, is were some of these warning signs ignored or overlooked because of the possibility that that his superiors were afraid that there may have been a backlash in reprimanding him because of, I'm speaking of Hassan, reprimanding him because of his religion. And if there is any religion, any culture that espouses violence, we simply have to take action. Mm. But I'm afraid there's a political correctness that prevents us from doing so. And the absolute tragic end result is there are 13 people dead.
Mm. Shireen, thank you. Daniel Zwerdling, political correctness here?
Well, I think Shireen has touched on something that a lot of people at Walter Reed are now thinking about. And I've talked to a few psychiatrists about it who've expressed those sorts of worries. But you know, I don't have any documentation to prove it, but they say that people, when they talked about Dr. Hassan, sometimes when folks sitting around the office would talk about him, there was this office chit-chat like, you know, the reason he's getting so far, even though we have so many concerns about him, is probably because he is Muslim and, you know, we are bending over backwards now in the military and in the government not to make it look like we're singling out a Muslim unfairly. And they all hasten to say, and nobody did. And again, they point to the, you know, their colleague who was Muslim, who was elected chief resident. But there is a lot of soul searching going on now, whether that sort of, you know, let's bend over backwards not to discriminate against somebody, even if we have concerns about him because of his professional behavior.
Here's Ned in Charlottesville, Virginia. Ned, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'd just like to broaden the conversation a little bit and take a step back and take this opportunity to bring everyone's attention to the fact that the types of wars that we are fighting now have an enormous psychological stress factor for the military. And that is because the enemies that we are fighting are not sovereign entities. They're not sovereign nations. They cannot surrender and sign a peace treaty. And therefore, no treaty is possible. And so the soldiers are stuck in a situation where they're being asked to use the tactics of war in what is really a police action. And the kind of stress that can come from that is being precipitated now. This has been going on now for 7, 8, 9 years. And I do think we need to take a look at what we call a war and the kinds of actions that we engage in.
And the repeated deployments. Ned, it's a great call and a good thought to bring up here. Here's a comment on that very point. Yesterday on Meet the Press, Army Chief of Staff General George Casey was asked about how he's dealing with the repeated deployments of U.S. troops and the toll that it is taking.
This is something we are keenly aware of, and you have heard me talk about the Army being out of balance for 2.5 years. And we have been working very hard to bring ourselves back in balance, and balance being a point where the soldiers are deploying at sustainable rates. We've made progress toward that, but we still have a way to go.
Ann Scott Tyson, what are the realities? An Army being out of balance, as the general said, how far are they being stretched?
Well, they're being severely stretched. Interestingly, the number of forces deployed now is greater than they were even at the surge of troops in Iraq. A lot of people aren't aware of that, that with the increases in Afghanistan, the pressure has remained very high. They have alleviated that slightly because recruiting has been better with the bad economy, and also they've grown some forces in the Army. They've added forces. They're building new brigades. But everyone in the Army realizes that this period, particularly with the possibility of tens of thousands more going to Afghanistan, will keep them at a very high, what they call operational tempo, meaning that the soldiers will, you know, at best have a year or a little bit more at home, which is filled with training and other activities, before they have to deploy again. There's no question, I think, that this is not contributing to the suicides. About a third of the forces coming back have some mental health problems, depression, anxiety, PTSD. And this is the backdrop that is, I think, contributing to acts of violence, whether it be the violence of taking one's own life or taking another life.
In fact, I think, Anne, you wrote the strain of the repeat deployments at Fort Hood specifically has had a significant impact, the highest number of suicides among Army installments since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003.
That's true, and they have had about 10 so far this year. I should caveat that by saying, I mean, Fort Hood is a very large base, so that also, you know, contributes right to the demographic, but certainly one that is emblematic of this heavy pressure.
Daniel Zwerdling, what do the soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq, or those going there, what do they face today that's different from soldiers past?
Well, of course, as we've all heard over the last 2 years, the battle in Afghanistan and Iraq, well, first of all, they're different from each other, but they're very different from Vietnam, for example. I mean, people day to day have no idea whether the person they're working with is going to turn around and try to, you know, blow them up that night with an IED or a mortar attack. And so there has been this huge rate of mental health problems. And I think the big backdrop that we should all be focusing on, just to build on what Anne said, starting 3 years ago and more, people like Anne and her colleagues at The Washington Post and I here at NPR started reporting on the fact that troops who came back from these wars with serious mental health problems, number one, had a terrible time getting help at the medical centers at their military bases. They would go in and say, I'm freaking out. I feel like I'm going to kill myself. And literally the clerk at the desk at the mental health clinic would say, okay, here's an appointment slip. Come back in 4 months. Mm. 4 months? Mm. I mean, worse than that even, not only could they not get adequate help, but as soon as people in the military, their commanders and their non-commissioned officers heard that they were having mental health problems, in many cases, the command structure would set out to destroy these troubled soldiers' lives, you know, right, because they weren't sucking it up like a man or right, like a woman. Right. And you know, so we've heard those stories. Anyway, so the military, the heads at the Pentagon and top government officials all said over the past few years, oh, we realize, you know, it's been terrible. We have not helped our valiant warriors enough, and we're going to start all kinds of programs to help them now. And I'm sad to say that over the past few years, most of these programs that have been set up have really been just what the military calls check the box. So you can say, oh, we've done it. And what that means is you send somebody to an auditorium for 1 hour, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm show them a video, you give them a boring lecture on PTSD and traumatic brain injury, and then you never talk
and
to them about
it. Let me hear from one of these soldiers, Daniel. Corbin is on the line from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Corbin, welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks. I know you're short time, so I'll be quick. 2 points. First of all, you know, the fact that he was Muslim and the people were giving him issues about that, I think because he was a jerk. And if he had been something else, they would have, you know, done those personal attacks to him and, you know, whatever it was. Second, I think that Lieberman's comments were inappropriate, and I think it's just trying to set the stage to say that, you know, now a terrorist attack has happened with Obama being in office. And I think that it's inappropriate for him to say that. And I think it's pretty clear that this was just like a Columbine guy or the person at Virginia Tech. He was upset, he was hurt, and he was going to do this anyway.
I'm curious, Corbin, as an active duty soldier, based on our last bit of questioning how you're dealing with deployments, how your fellow soldiers are dealing with repeated combat deployments.
Well, we're getting ready to deploy here pretty quickly in the next couple of months, and for the most part, it's our job, and it's what we do. And most people, you know, you do what you need to do. There's plenty of counseling. The Army and the military is extremely cognizant of the challenges and the emotional stress. There are numerous programs that are in place to help. There's Army Community Services and so forth. And all commanders care about their soldiers. And if there's issues that are going on from, you know, the private to the generals, they're cognizant of that, and they look out for that, and they try to help. You know, it's a stressful situation, and if people can't handle it, they tend to get out of the Army.
Corbin, I really appreciate your time and your service. Thank you, sir. Daniel Swerdling, I'll give you the final word here in our last 30 seconds on this day.
If Corbin and his colleagues have plenty of access to good counseling and other help, that is fantastic news. And I think one thing it might reflect is the fact that in the military, which is such a huge institution, some people are lucky and have that support, but I'm hearing constantly from a lot of Marines and soldiers who say we don't have any of that good support yet.
Daniel Swerdling, thank you very much for your time and your perspective. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Swerdling is national correspondent for National Public Radio. And Ann Scott Tyson, I appreciate your time today. Ann, military and Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you, Ann.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, On Point Radio. Find us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.